All right. This is Daniel Thacker with the South Texas Archives, and we are doing an interview today here on February 28th, 2019, with Peggy Westbrook of Kingsville, Texas. And I'm also sitting here with Karen Meadows. She'll also be helping me interview Peggy Westbrook. Peggy, thank you very much for sharing this afternoon with us and sharing us with us your story.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
Thank you. I guess we'll start off. When and where were you born?
I was born in Luling, Texas, 1931, July the 5th. The same year that President Roosevelt became president.
And that was Luling, Texas?
Luling, Texas.
Mm-hmm. And what was your mother and father's names?
My mother was named Willie Jowers Wright, and my dad's name was Edwin Wright.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had a sister named Shirley, and she ended up being Shirley Wright Marburger.
Marburger.
Okay. She married Marburger, and that was the only sibling I had. And she died about 3 years ago. She was younger than I, but she was very ill.
Okay. And what were your first memories?
I guess my first memory is a strange lady waking me up in some bed that I wasn't familiar with. And she said, "Don't you want to go see your new baby sister?" And I thought, I didn't order a baby sister. I mean, strange woman in my house, and I was in a strange bed. They had moved me from my bedroom because it was next to mother's bedroom, and the baby was born at home. And I never heard a word, see, until that next morning. I woke up, and I thought, this is not my room. Where am I? But it was up front, you know, and yeah, that's my first memory. Okay. You know, I don't remember anything other than that because it was a magnificent memory, and it was kind of jarring. I mean, like I said, I didn't order a baby sister. Why do I have to have one?
It was okay like it was.
Exactly. But that's my first memory, you know, and she was such a cute little baby and made me mad because they named her Shirley. Because at that time, we all worshipped Shirley Temple. Mm. Shirley with the beautiful curly hair, and here I was just ugly. And we saw every Shirley Temple movie. And then my sister was named Shirley, but her curls dried up after a while. She didn't have curls that long.
Yes.
But I thought that was so tacky of me, but that's just kind of the way I felt. You know,
you're a
I just
kid.
Nobody talked about pregnancy in those days. I didn't know my mother was having a baby. I couldn't tell. I didn't notice. Nowadays, it's family business. Everybody knows, but back in those days, it was very quiet, like it was something unfortunate you don't want to talk about. It's my earliest memories.
Did you stay in Luling, Texas for long, or did you move around?
No, we moved from there to Refugio.
Refugio, okay. Mm-hmm. How old were you?
I was three.
Three, okay.
And then when I was four, we moved to Freer, to a humble camp. Outside of Freer, one of the better camps, bigger, nicer. And they had a kindergarten, and I learned to walk to kindergarten without being afraid because it was contained in a camp and it was right down the street. You know, I wasn't being hovered, but I could stay on the sidewalk all the way down there and go to kindergarten. That was a really unusual experience because they had a playground. And I didn't know anything about I knew about swings, but I didn't know about seesaws. So I got on the seesaw. The little boy sat there, and I was up there. He got off. And then I fell down, and it just about killed me. I didn't know what had happened. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried. Some nice woman took me home. But, you know, those are the kind of things that... So when my children got old enough to be on the seesaw, don't get off the seesaw. Elevate yourself so that it comes level, then you can get off. I was hell-bent they were not going to do that to anybody else because it was horrible.
Yeah.
And I thought I was ruined for life. But, yeah, that was one of my memories of kindergarten. Then we moved to Taft, and that's where I started first grade, Taft, Texas.
First grade. Now, you said a humble camp, so yes. That was your father an oil man?
Humble oil, and every place, like Luling when we lived there, I mean, not when we lived there, but after my dad, after I was born, that became a production town, just like, as long as you're drilling out, they don't know where they're going to find anything or not, so they're not going to invest in a camp unless it's already been proved. So from then on, we moved from camp to camp, see. But Luling, we did not live in a company house or in a camp. They didn't have one at that time. Later, in Refugio, we didn't have a camp there until the next time we moved there, and then there was a camp there.
And everybody in town kind of looked down on y'all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oil field trash. Uh-huh. Especially, like, Refugio was full of ranchers and their property. Of course, they're not thinking about that oil. I wouldn't have any decent thing, just like the King Ranch. If they hadn't discovered oil in 28, the ranch was in bad trouble then. So King Ranch has always been good to oil field people, allowing them to build camps, two camps on the ranch. And they were looked down on us, they were friendly with us. And that was a real eye-opener. And when I lived at Kelsey Bass, that was another camp that was built on a ranch land.
So how long did y'all live in Refugio?
Well, that time we lived just a couple of years, then we moved to Freer. And then we went back to Refugio. I started junior high in Woodsboro because we couldn't get a house in Refugio because of the war. And we found a house in Woodsboro that belonged to a doctor who had gone off to war. Lovely home, just a block from the school. I could walk to school. My sister and I could walk to school. Lovely little town. Small, intimate, friendly. Kids could walk up and down at night. It didn't make any difference. Nothing was wrong in Freer. It was perfect. I mean, Woodsboro. And then we moved from there to Refugio because the war was over and the doctor wanted his house back. So we had to find a house in Refugio, so we moved over there. It was where my cousin lived, and I had two cousins that lived there, so we had a good time. We went to that school. And then at the last minute, Daddy says, well, I'm sorry, we're moving to Freer, and you'll be a senior there. You'll be graduating. And I threw a fit. I said, let me stay with my cousin, Daddy. Let me stay with my cousin. He said, no, your cousin's leaving too because the war had ended. So all the farmers, like my uncles, had been brought off the farm to come for the war effort and let the young men go off to war. Well, all young men were coming back, and they wanted their jobs back. So my uncles went back to Grosbeck and went back to their farms, and my cousins went back to their farms, and I lost them as constant companions. So it was something to go to Freer, and I thought, my life is ruined. So I'm losing all my friends.
So you grew up in Refugio during the war. How scary was it to be a little kid during the war?
Well, it wasn't so scary till we moved to Taft. That's where it's closer to the bay. And we were in Refugio, then we moved to Taft. Daddy was a gauger out there in the oil field in Taft. A lovely little town, friendly and nice. Walk to the movie theater. Girls and boys could walk anywhere. There's no crime. It was a calm little town. But during the war, it was scary because, like I said, we used to play outside at night with our porch lights on and flashlights. We were playing hide and seek and things like that. And all of a sudden, the government said, in that area, do not drive at night. Don't you have your porch light on. Get blackout curtains because there are U-boats hovering over the gust close to Corpus Christi where they have this huge refinery. And in Ingleside, which they had a huge refinery, my uncle worked in the refinery. And so they were even under worse conditions than we were. They really had to have blackouts, you know. And a Taft was far enough away, but it was level. So there's nothing to interfere. So the light would just go right on out to the Gulf. So we had to be restricted by what we could do.
Now, did you say that your father saw a U-boat?
No, it was uncle.
Your uncle saw mm-hmm. He was mm-hmm. working out?
Evidently, he was out probably going fishing and right. found out he shouldn't do that. Someone told him, and there are U-boats out there. So he wanted to go find one.
What's your ancestry?
As far as I know, my mother's family's name was Jowers, mm-hmm. and that's Irish.
Okay.
And maybe some Scottish. Now, my right name, my grandfather told me, and he was a minister, he's a preacher, so I thought, well, he knows what he's talking about, that his mother came from a long line of, I can't remember the names of them, but he said they were direct Descendants was for Francis Drake. And I thought, don't really realize that I ever read that Francis Drake married. That didn't mean he didn't have kids. But I mean, I thought, how do you trace things like that? Yeah. But that was what we were told, that your great-great-grandmother, great-great-great-grandmother was a daughter of Sir Francis Drake, whatever that meant.
So you would have been English.
Yeah, I thought he was probably an English privateer or something. They called him Sir Francis, mm-hmm. but I think he was very
scoundrel,
nice.
Scoundrel.
Yeah.
So you weren't German?
No German. Okay. Anyway.
Did they ever segregate any of the Germans or...
No,
okay.
They were not treated like the Japanese. They were farmers. We had a whole, I lived in Woodsboro, like I said earlier. Woodsboro was a nice, it was like a little railroad town. But outside of Woodsboro was wonderful farmland, and it was called Bonnie View. And all the people lived in Bonnie View came from, directly from Germany. That was, I guess, when Adolf Hitler started doing his thing. They emigrated. So we had some good friends that were in fact, Dolores Price and I got to be friends when we were girls because her aunt's father and mother owned a farm out there, and Dolores's dad was how I met her, because her dad, I mean, not Dolores's dad, but her mother's cousin was my mother's friend. So we got to, somehow families got together. And so we were allowed, we were invited to go out to the German family's home in the summer. Dolores and I got to, it was like a treat going out to a farm where you could get to feed the chickens and have fresh milk and peaches and, you know, just wonderful. And what was so interesting, these parents, even though they had not come from Germany themselves, their parents, they all spoke German. Nothing was wrong about that. Bonnie View and all that area. So my mother would go shopping in Woodsboro on the weekend, and she'd come home and she'd say, you know, it really worries me. And I said, what's that? She said, well, I walk by these people on the street. They're very friendly, but they're all speaking German. She said, how do we know they're not spies? And I said, Mother, what would they spy, you know, in these little farms? You know, what would they be doing? There's no facility around there for them to... Besides, they came over during the time it was really bad in Germany. They're very, you know, very stalwart. In fact, my little friend whose father and mother owned that farm, she was talking about the last time her brother, his name was Manfred, came home from being in the army, and he knew he was going overseas. And his mother was very sad, and his father was sad to know that he was going back to Germany to kill Germans because they still had relatives. But the younger sister spoke up and she says, okay, Manfred, let's put it this way. Just say, hi, cousin, and shoot him. I mean, she was notorious, you know, for making up stuff like that. And, of course, it upset her mother, but her dad kind of grinned. He thought, well, I guess that's the kind of attitude. You're going to go fight your relatives, you know. And I thought, well, that's happened so many times, like in our own country, the North and the South.
Did y'all do without a lot of things in Taft, like sugar?
My gosh. In South Texas, you didn't get anything, except when you go to Mexico, you could get it all.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. Cross the border, go down there. We could get shoes there. I mean, there were times we couldn't get leather shoes. See, my dad never bought another pair of shoes during the whole war. He saved the stamps, because you had to have stamps to buy shoes. So he saved the stamps for my sister and me because we would outgrow our shoes. And he took such good care of his shoes. They looked like $100 all the time. He kept them polished and shined. And if he saw it was running over, he'd go get some taps and put on them. So I could hear his walking down the sidewalk. He walked like a dancer. I always thought he sounded like Fred Astaire. I was at a movie theater. He was supposed to pick me up. And I got out and everything. I was the last one. I was standing waiting for my daddy to pick me up. And I was there. I was getting scared because the lights were going out. You know, the town of Freer, not many lights in there. All of a sudden, I heard this walk. And he'd parked down the street visiting with some friends, and he realized it was Stuart. So he didn't drive down. He just walked. And I could tell by his walk, the gait, and the clicking of the taps. That's my daddy coming. And so, anyway, yeah, those are kind of memories you stick with because they're special.
So you would go across to Mexico and you could buy all the sugar you wanted. You
we had people shoes. That would go over there. Yeah, and then on Sunday one day, we got news that this little Jewish man had a little shoe store, a little dry goods store in Refugio. He's going to be open after church. If you want to go buy some shoes, he has them. He went to Mexico and brought them back. They were leather.
So were they black market shoes?
No, they just made them in Mexico. They weren't very stylish. They were, what do you call them?
Huaraches?
Yes.
Yeah.
But they were leather, which beat, oh, goodness, all what we were getting. We were getting cloth shoes that were awful. You know, it's awful. Daddy never bought a new pair of shoes. My mother did, and of course we girls had to because our feet grew. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I remember that man. People didn't like him. I don't think he was Jewish. I think he was a foreigner, but I don't think he was Jewish because he had some children and they came to school and they didn't act like they had a different religion or anything. But he was, that's what they called. The little Jew man downtown is going to open the store and we're going to buy some shoes. So anyway, black market or whatever, we got some shoes, well, some sandals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
We were rationed quite a bit. Yeah, we had a hard time finding. A lot of stuff was sent overseas.
When did you first realize that you had an artistic gift? Did you draw as a young girl, or did you have an art teacher that would?
I never had but one art teacher in my life in grade school. First grade, we didn't have an art teacher. We just had a regular teacher. Uh-huh. That we had two of them. But second grade, we had an art teacher. And I could not draw. I couldn't even use a pencil. My mother was so strict. I went to kindergarten, a private kindergarten in the camp. But we didn't use crayons or anything because we didn't mess anything up. We played little games and things like that. We played outside. We had a playground. That's when I was, turned off some, seesaws because I never wanted to get on another one. But we didn't learn anything, you know. She read stories to us and we did things. So when I started first grade, got a notebook that said, draw an apple. I took this crayon, I never had one in my life, took this crayon and started to draw, and I couldn't draw a circle. It was strange, and I realized that's not a circle, I need to make it more hair. Well, there was no way to erase what I'd already done, so it was the strangest looking thing that ever was, and I was so ashamed. Everybody else had drawn an apple, and I went home in tears. I said, Mother, I need some crayons, I need to practice, and she said, well, I don't know that I should get you and mark up the wall. They'd get so mad because they rented. They didn't want to mess up anything, you know. I will not mark on the wall, Mother. Just give me some paper, you know. So finally I got some crayons and I started learning to draw. But I'll never forget how bad I felt about not being able to draw a circle. My fingers wouldn't do it. I made sure my babies had crayons when they were in the high chair. We drew. And all, but Mother was so in. Well, back in those days, if you rented property, you better not have one mark on the wall or one thing broken or you're in trouble. That's the way she felt. So I had to be really good and not mess up anything. But after I got to where I could draw, that's all I wanted to do. Didn't want to do anything else.
How old were you when you started to get better? And
about 8.
About it? No kidding. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I had a really nice teacher and a good friend who was her niece. So we would sit close to each other and we were supposed to be doing our math homework or something like that, or working. And she'd have a little sheet of paper and she'd draw something on it and she'd pass it back to me and I'd look at it and I'd draw something, for her. And I'd think, that's what we did instead of learning math, So I got started and I loved it, and Mother would buy me crayons and coloring books and things like that. So I finally got, I only had one art teacher in my life until I started college.
Who was that?
And just a lady that just taught us to be free and easy. She was a real artist. She was more of an artist than a teacher, but I just loved her. Redheaded, just so strange, so good. And I just admired her so much, but I never had an art class later because the other schools, after the war started, they were hard finding teachers to do anything. They brought in old ladies out of the woodwork to be our teachers. All the young women left because they had married men that got, you know, drafted, and they went to live home with their mothers. And our school system was really hit hard in South Texas by the exodus of the young women that had just gotten their degrees and had all this information. And we got the old ladies who came back and didn't really do a whole lot. So 1945, we started getting better teachers again.
And you were around 15, 14 years old around then?
I graduated when I was 16, 48. 16,
okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, yeah, and I was too young. Dad, I was 16, and Daddy said, you can't go off to college. You're going to have to find a job here in town, and then when you get older.
And that was in Freer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're living in Freer when you graduated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was lucky to find a job. And one of his friends had a trucking business. And he needed someone in the office to answer the phone and deal with things like that. And so that's what I did.
Cool.
And then we went to Alice. We moved to Alice, and I went to work for the telephone company, thinking that I had talked to someone, a friend of mine, who was also working for the telephone company. And she told me that probably I could get a transfer after a certain amount of time to go to San Antonio. And there was the art school I wanted to go to. So I was working towards that when I met Richard.
I was going to ask, did you date a lot in high school? Or there?
Never got to go. But I married him, and we ended up living in Kingsville long enough that I went to art classes here in the college.
So it's an interesting story about your first date with Richard.
Oh, gosh. It was awful. Poor thing.
I've heard it, but thank you to hear it. Yeah.
How old were you when you had your first date?
18. 18. With him. I was 19 when I got married. He was the neighbor of a really good friend of my mother and dad's. And I loved her a lot. She was really sweet. And her daughter and I were good friends. And her daughter was killed. She went to Premont High School. And the bus stopped on the highway because the lights went out of the bus. And the bus driver couldn't drive without lights. And so Anne got out of the bus, and she was holding a flashlight so the engine part could be seen and find out what was wrong. And some of the other kids had come around, you know, but Anne was where she could throw the light on there. And she got hit by a car and killed instantly.
Oh.
So her mother and father were just so upset, you know, but she was my best friend. And she lived here in Kingsville, and we lived in Alice. So anyway, her mother loved Richard. She got to know him, and she said, you know, I have someone you ought to go with, and you ought to have a date with. I said, oh, well, maybe someday. No, come over this weekend. Just come over this week. Spend the weekend with me. So mother brought me over, and I stayed there. And so poor Richard didn't know anything about this. His sister had set it up. So he'd been fishing. He'd gotten up at 3:00 in the morning to go fishing, and he came home. It was like 6:00. He was sunburned. He was tired. He was hot. He was furious with her. Richard L., get in there and get a shower. You've got a date with this girl. He said, I don't have any dates. Yes, I've made one for you. So you can imagine it was not a real pleasant evening. He tried his best, but we did find a place to dance. That was back in those days, there was no air conditioning places in Kingsville. Where we went to dance was what used to be a little Mexican restaurant that had a lovely patio area and a jukebox. And it was cool because the South Texas winds were blowing. You didn't have to have an AC. Inside, it was warm, but outside, it was wonderful. So we danced. After then, he invited me to go to Corpus, and we went to the roof garden over there for the same reason. There was no place air-conditioned to dance. And that was, you climb these steps, and there's this great big building, and nothing underneath but just substantial holding up this thing. And they had a roof, and they had a band, and they had music, and we danced. So I told my mother, I said, I hope you don't mind that if I'm working at the telephone company, I don't get off till 10:30, and he's going to pick me up at 10:30, and we're going to go to Corpus and dance. I hope that doesn't disappoint you. She said, well, no, go ahead. She said, you'll be home by 1:00, and I said, probably. So that's what happened. So anyway, we ended up getting married, and it was okay. I don't think I would have gotten married as soon if he had not been sent to Kelsey Bass, because he was living at home and working, you know, and he didn't really feel like He was alone. He had his family taking good care of him. But when he was moved, transferred to Kelsey Bass, 45 miles from Falfurrias, and living in a bunkhouse with all these other guys, he decided maybe he'd rather be married. So that's how I got invited to be married. Moved into a 27-foot trailer, as you can see, which is a delightful-looking little thing.
Yes, and we do have a picture, and that'll be in your collection.
When I had the baby, I had to get rid of all the living room furniture because the crib took up all the room.
So you had your first daughter Anne while you lived in the... And were you still living at Kelsey Bass when you had Anne?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And finally, we got transferred to Fulton, Rockport, but we had to live in Fulton. Behind the Fulton Mansion, they had this summer cottage. Two big rooms, a hall with a closet on one side and a bathroom on the other side. But this one big room was kitchen and dining area. You go down the hall to the other big room, and it was living in bedrooms. And the windows were huge, tall, tall, tall. And it was a summer cottage. But we lived there in November and December and January, and it was so cold. And there was no place for Anne to play outside because it was shale. I mean, the shell, you know.
Those oyster shells. Yeah.
And so we had this long porch, a screened-in porch.
A sleeping porch, right? Isn't that what they call them?
And she could ride her tricycle there, and I had my washing machine there. And so I could be washing, and she'd be playing out there. And that. But I didn't let her get outside because the shell would have pierced her skin. She'd have been all the time. But I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. We can pause it.
And you hear I can talk.
Oh, here.
Better shut up. Nobody wants to identify themselves.
Yeah.
They're trying to get me to buy. No, they're trying to get me my name and everything so that I can be part of the whatever they're selling at that time.
I know. I don't pay attention. It was a foreign sounding voice.
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh yes. And he calls me Peggy.
Yeah.
I don't know him.
So you had your child, but you started taking classes at Texas A&I, correct?
Yes. Richard didn't have to go to work until 10:30, and I would go to early classes with a friend of mine, another Exxon wife, mm-hmm. who had three little boys, and only had Anne at that time. And she said, let's go together. And at that time, the art building, there wasn't an art building. The art classes were held up in the attic of one of the other old buildings, so we'd have to climb those stairs, and it was dark and forbidding. But we went together, and it was a great class. We enjoyed it. A lot of, the college kids took it, too. I mean, it was not just for old people.
So it was on the Kingsville campus?
Mm-hmm.
On top. What building was it close to?
One of the old ones.
Like Nearman?
It was, no, not that one. It was the second one. I keep looking at it, and I can't remember the name of it.
Okay.
But it was, you had to climb three sets of stairs to get up.
It was right over there by the old Nearman mm-hmm.
yeah.
building. Yeah, now the science building.
Yeah. Mary Lou and I went every week, and we learned a lot. We were older, and we were interested in learning. Some of those kids were taking that class because they figured it was just a cheap class. It didn't matter. You still could graduate even if you failed it, no big deal. But we were anxious to learn. I took several courses out there.
Did you find a certain medium? Did you experiment
with
different mediums?
Well, we started with oil. That's what they did. And then we had another teacher that came in from Mexico, actually. He was from Mexico. And he started us on acrylic. And I thought, oh, that's my gift from God. Because oil was so dreary, you had to wait and wait and wait for it to dry. And acrylic, you could just work with it so fast, and I loved that. And that's kind of what I'm using with Santa Claus. It's only it's not acrylic like we did for paintings, but it is an acrylic base, and it dries quickly, and it covers a lot, and I really enjoy that. So, but I started doing watercolor then after Dolores moved here. So,
watercolors, fun.
And pastel, I learned to use pastel in Australia. And then in Alaska, I had a pastel teacher. So, every place I lived, I tried to take classes and learn something.
Now, how long did you and your husband stay in the Fur area in that Kelsey camp?
Well, let's see. Anne was born in Valpurgis. And when she was... Oh, and I got rattlesnake bitten.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I was walking through the backyard, going to a neighbor in the back of the camp, which was protected, supposedly protected. But what happened when they moved some pipe in and stored it because they were through with the pipe, they were moving to another location, they brought the pipe in the camp and stored it. And what they discovered was that inside the there was a snake that was like laying her eggs. When the eggs all hatched and came out, those little snakes were everywhere. Mm. I wasn't the only victim. I was the only grown-up, but there was a little boy that was bitten, and I was at night, and he was in the daytime. But when I felt that thing bite me on my foot, happened to have a low-cut shoe, it felt like a hypodermic needle. I called Richard. I said, will you please put her in the bathtub and watch her? I'm going to go across the way and give something to my neighbor. I'll be right back. So just stay in the bathroom. Just put her in the bathtub. Let her play, but don't walk out of the room. And when that hit me, my old friend that was with me, Doris, I said, Doris, I think I've just been bitten by a rattlesnake. So she put her flashlight down there and she saw, you have. And she beat that snake to death with the flashlight.
Mm.
And I was hollering at Richard, come in here. So he bundled up Ann and came out. What's wrong? I said, I've been bitten by a rattlesnake. So he yelled at somebody to call a couple of guys, put me in the back seat of the car with a couple of guys, and they had the snake bite kit, and he was driving me to Falfurrias as fast as he could. Those curving little roads and everything, and I was so scared I was going to have a car crash that I was afraid of that. I wasn't even thinking about the snake bite. I was so, why did you let him drive, But then I was allergic to the stuff they gave me, so I was in the hospital longer than I should have been. As my mother came down from Victoria and got my daughter, and Richard brings home a puppy from the rig. And I was in bed, and I said, what did you do? Well, this little puppy was out there, and he was starving to death, and I felt like I'd just bring home, and we'd feed him. And I said, I'm supposed to get out of bed and feed this animal. And, well, anyway, it's a really sad story because after I got over it, everything was fine. The puppy was still around. And I ran over it accidentally. I didn't mean to. It broke my heart. But at least I ran over it before Ann got home, so she never saw that we had a little puppy or that I ran over it, so she never knew that. But I felt so bad about it. But Richard let it out, and he was running around, and I pulled the car in. I didn't see him. He just was in front of me before I knew it, and I hit him. Oh, gosh, it was horrible.
So that's when you lived at Kelsey Bass, right? Mm-hmm. How long did y'all live there?
Well, after that's when we went to Rockport. It was, Anne was a little bit older at that time, so we were there for the time. And that's where I lived when she was born, and I was 30 days late having her, and we had no telephones. People would drop by, are you in labor yet? No. Because I had to go to Falfurrias if I were, and I wasn't, so I was very late.
So you lived in, you went from there to Fulton and Rockport, and how long did you live there?
Oh, not very long. Then we went to, came back to Kingsville. Went back to the church. We had our MYF group and went back just long enough to get them started again. And then, bingo, we got shipped to Port Lavaca.
Port Lavaca.
And that's, I got pregnant up there with Ricky. I had her, Victoria.
Okay.
What was her name?
Ricky. Ricky.
What?
Ricky.
Ricky.
Ricky. Yeah, okay. Ricky Westbrook. Ricky Cunningham, now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you had your second daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were y'all in Port Lavaca?
Oh, not long, because we got back to Kingsville. We came back to Kingsville. It was still a camp.
Port Lavaca was?
No, this was Stratton Camp was out here.
Okay.
In Kingsville. On the ranch, yeah. Seligson Camp was on that side of the ranch. So anyway, we got there when they decided they were going to do away with the camps. So our house went up for sale. And so Richard bought a house here in town that had been a company house. I did not have any part of that. I didn't want to be.
Well, that's your second house you didn't have a part in.
That's right. So I thought, we're not going to do this again. So then we had Chipper.
Your son. So this was your third child. Son,
yeah. And we had him here in town.
What was his name?
His name is Richard L. Westbrook III, okay. But we call him Chip. Chip off the old block. He's a golfer, works for Celanese. Yeah. Anyway, it was so interesting because he was the only grandson on either side of the family. So he was not spoiled at all.
Yeah, right.
And the baby, Ricky could never forgive him because she was her grandmother's little favorite until Chip came along. And to this day, she can't stand her brother. And I said, you know what that is, don't you? She said, what? And I said, jealousy. Because until he was born, you were grandmother's favorite. And all of a sudden, women of her generation would latch on to the little boys. And so there you were without any... You know, Anne had Wimberly, the cousin. They were the same age, and there was Ricky with nobody. So, yeah, it's long and drawn out. Sometimes it's sad, but.
So you actually lived in an humble camp on the King Ranch.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And Richard worked for humble how many years?
Oh, my gosh, I can't remember. He went to work at 18, and when he retired in Alaska, it's a long time.
Did you like living in the camps?
It wasn't too bad. It was nice. We only had one car, and school bus would pick up kids. You didn't have to drive kids to school. People were very close and pretty much more or less compatible. I tried to stay that. I didn't want to get cliquish with any particular group. You know, I just meet friends. I still have them. When we all had to give away our camp life and go into the city and find, you know, other interests to get into. Although I was one of the few that joined all the clubs I could, and even though I lived in the camp, because I realized that it can be a polarizing experience when you just stay with whoever you're living beside. You need to spread out and get active. And I told Richard, I said, and you need to also, even though you're devoted to your company, you need to do something. So we took over the MYF at the church with our two little kids.
What is the NYF?
Methodist Youth Fellowship. Mm-hmm. We did that for many years until we were moved again to Port Lavaca. And at that time, they had a radio station. The youth did, and our little radio station here on Saturday afternoons, those kids would go, and they were volunteering, and they'd play music, and I could get it in Port Lavaca. And I would call them and tell them how much fun it was hearing them talk and everything. And we came back to Kingsville. We were with them as they graduated and got married, and we still are with them because we get Christmas cards every year, and, you know, that group has been wonderful.
I want to make sure I got that. That was the MYF?
Methodist Youth Fellowship.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. So when did you move to Australia first or Alaska first?
Australia.
When?
1971.
Oh, okay. 1971.
Was that a choice for y'all to move? Did y'all kind of get to say yes or no?
It was a big drilling program, and my husband didn't ever turn down that. Okay. It was his lifestyle. He was not a person that worked on a rig that was producing. His was exploration, and that was what was attracted him to that.
That's exciting.
Exactly, and he had a huge budget, you know. But he had to be very wise in selecting the people that would want the jobs to sell things to you. And so he had to be very selective and know how these people were. So we would wine and dine them to kind of find out who they were and what they were really after, you know. Made some good friends that way. I just laughed. I said, I know I'm not supposed to take gifts from any of these people. He said, you absolutely not. I said, fat chance. I said, they give me things that I don't have to report. One man gave me some beautiful silk from Thailand. And I said, Exxon doesn't need to know about that.
Mm-mm. No.
I'm not selling it. I'm making it. I made it to wear to Chipper's wedding. I made a little outfit to wear.
So you're an artist in various ways. You not only paint, but you also
I learned to sew. I had to learn to sew because my mother insisted on it. She told me she could teach me better than any homemaking teacher, and she could. So, yeah, I sewed it for my girls and my son and my husband. I used to make his shirts. You know why? He smoked. He wanted two pockets, and most of the shirts only had one pocket. He carried everything in his pockets up there, you know, and I'd have to make his shirts for him. His mother got jealous and decided she's going to make a shirt for him. She really did. She thought, well, I can do that for my boy. So she made this shirt for him. He brought it home, and he said, Peggy, look at this shirt. And I said, well, this looks very nice. He said, look at the buttons. She put it on the wrong side.
Like a girl's blouse. Like a woman's blouse.
He wouldn't wear it. I said, what are you going to do? He said, don't tell my mom, but I'm just not going to wear it. I'll maybe wear it to her house, but I'm not going to be seen out in it. And I thought, well, you should have told her ahead of time, you know, to be sure and put the buttons where there's, but she didn't think about it, you know. She's used to making clothes for her daughter, not her son. But I was making shirts for Richard and Chipper, so I knew better.
So you lived in Kingsville, and you had your third child, Chipper, right?
What year was that?
What year was Chipper born?
59? I can't remember. God, I can't
thereabout,
remember.
Close right. enough.
Yeah. I just
he's 60. I know that he's 60, so he's old.
I just didn't want to skip over anything. No. So.
It was Ann first, then Ricky, and then Chip. I think it's 59.
Okay. Well, yeah, because it's 19, so mm-hmm. that would come mm-hmm. up to an even number. So did you, in the 71 when you moved, so Chipper would have been 11 when you moved to Australia. Mm-hmm. So did all your kids go with you when you moved to Australia?
No, Anne was already married. She got married, which was a real mistake. She shouldn't have, but yeah. She should have gone with us. Because when we came back 2 years later, we found out she'd gone through hell, and we never knew it, but it was okay. It worked out.
So you had Ricky in Australia, and you had...
No, I had Ricky here. No. We had him with us, Chipper and Ricky.
And Ricky. We went to Australia, right.
And I didn't get to come home. See, Richard got to come home because he had to go to a meeting in Houston, so he got to fly home. I didn't get to, so it was in October, so we got all the Christmas gifts from my family. So he could put them in his suitcase and take them in October and for their Christmas. So we wouldn't have to ship them because it cost so much to ship them from Australia. And then he picked up what they wanted me to have and put it in his suitcase and brought it back to Australia for me. And that was the way it was. Now, when we went in Alaska, I got to go home twice a year.
So when you lived in Australia, did you like living in town or was it kind of like living in a camp?
It was a small town, but it was very friendly. They liked the Americans. They really did because, we were outgoing people and we spoke the same language they did, you know. And, I looked at some of those people. I think I look like I'm kin to them. You know, they have one of the men I saw one night at a restaurant. I looked across. I thought, that looks just like my uncle. I don't think, Peggy, we all came from the same part of the world. It could be related somewhere along the line. So, but they were always friendly. And Richard kept saying, I don't understand what's going on. He said, I go up, people come and start talking to me. And he said, they just keep asking questions and I keep answering them. And he'd keep asking questions. And I said, well, what do you think they're doing? And she said, well, I'm thinking they're just trying to figure out what I'm saying. So one lady said one time, why is it that your language is different than your wife's? He couldn't think what to say, except he said, she went past the third grade. Which was the only way he could think of. I told him, I said, you know what the problem is? You're speaking East Texan, and I'm not. I never lived in East Texas. I grew up in South Texas. But East Texas has its own language, like Louisiana.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so really they say things differently in a different cadence. And these people in Australia didn't have any problem with it, but they did Richard's because they didn't always understand it. He said, I think people just talk to me just to hear me talk. I said, that could be true.
So this whole time, that you're living in Kingsville, you're very involved. And then you moved to Australia,
oh, yeah.
right? Because mm-hmm. there's an art league in Kingsville. There's all kinds of things
there's
to
an
do.
Art league in Australia.
Okay, that's what
had
I was going to ask.
Wonderful class there.
Yeah.
And one of the ladies that taught was American, and she was there. She was from Chicago. And I bought one of her paintings and brought it home as a memento of sale. And then when I moved to Alaska, I had a lot more time. I had no kids with me there. I was alone all day. From 5 till 10, you know, I was alone. And I could get out and do whatever I wanted to do. I decided first thing I was going to do is get out and learn to drive in the snow, not worry about it, just get out and find people and get involved. And I got involved with some artists and classes and everything, and I really enjoyed that. And I painted in some art teachers workshops that came through, and I painted some beautiful paintings, and I'm proud of them. I had a friend in Freer that told me, oh, you're going to Australia? Oh, I mean, Alaska? Oh, she said, those children are so ugly. I said, I never found them ugly. I never had been, but I just didn't think, you know. So anyway, I got over there, and I couldn't help myself. I did a pastel portrait of a little Alaska baby. Cutest little thing I ever did I wanted her to see it, but she never did see it. It had a little parka, you know, little fur.
They have little
sweet little face, you know, just loved them. Mm-hmm. And every place you'd go, they'd be hanging on their dead on mama's backs, you know, so you could see the babies before you saw the mama. But you'd smile at them, and they'd smile back. They were so cute. I love that picture. I've told my grandchildren, you can pick out a painting and take it. I've got more than I need. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. When I die, someone's just going to take them, haul them to the dump or something. So, but nobody has touched that one. I think I'm not giving that one away. It's hanging in the hall back there, and I love it. So
just a reminder, the archives does take paintings if you ever wanted to archive. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I'm glad to know that, because I didn't know what I would do with it, what my family would do with it. I don't think they all want all of these. Yeah.
So if we go back to Australia, what was your favorite part of living in Australia?
Favorite part? The Country Women's Association. They let me, the only Yank that joined, become the president.
Oh, wow.
I had to learn how to have proper... proper ways, and they did, and I had to present things to the queen. Not personally, she didn't come over, but I mean, to do the ritual that they always do for the queen. You know, and here I'm an American, and some Americans say, well, we don't have anything to do with that queen. And I think, well, yes, we do. We owe that to her. I'm living in her country, you know, I can be nice. But yeah, I really enjoyed being part of it because I had one little, they were simple little old ladies, a lot of them were widows, and they appreciated the fact that I was a Yank, and I wanted to get to know them, and I came and joined with them, and I learned to drink tea the way they're supposed to. Now, first time I went to church at night for a meeting, the lady said, well, if you'll fix the cups for the tea, I can be doing this. I said, okay, what do I do? She said, put a little milk in each cup. And I said, a little milk? Yes, just, you know, in each cup. I said, what if someone doesn't want any milk? Well, just leave a few cups plain. I'm like, okay. So I put a little, you know, I didn't know they drank milk. And, you know, I always thought it was cream. Well, it's not. It's milk. I don't put cream. They put cream in their coffee, but not in the tea. So I learned number one. And not all of them use sugar, you know. So I had to learn to serve the tea. It's sort of a ritual. You just learn how to do that. So I tried to do that. And in the Country Women's Association, learned a lot of things. I learned all kinds of crafts that I never kept up with, but home crafts, they called them. It was just really charming, and I loved doing all that. And their sewing and quilting and embroidery, and oh my gosh, we made all kinds of things I no longer have, but you know, they were just, I wanted to be with them and learn how to do it. We had afternoon tea every Friday. We took turns. We had a little house that we rented close to the downtown area, because the little widow ladies didn't drive. Their husbands never taught them to drive. They had no idea how to use their money. They had to go to the bank and draw out enough money to buy groceries. Whoever was in charge of their accounts would give them a check and cash it for them. their husbands didn't think women had enough sense to know how to manage money. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what a wonderful way to live. And you didn't have to worry about anything. Someone's going to take care of you. But not American way, you know, but I thought it was good for them. But I know we were talking one day. Oh, I went to a country. It was an auction, a house, a family had died. And it was an auction. And I decided I'm just going to drive down there and see what it is. And I bought something there. It was a washstand. And it's Victorian and it was wood. And anyway, I bought it. Then I had to have mine get it home, you know. So I talked to a man there at the auction place, and he said, we can get it back to you. I said, okay. And I told him where I lived. But I put it in the hall, entry hall. I thought it goes really nice there. So we're having church circle at my house. And as the ladies left, pastor's wife came over. She said, this is Westbrook. She said, nobody mentioned it tonight, but I just think I need to tell you something. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, you Americans have a way of getting some of our stuff and our things that we used to use or still use and make it a decorative piece. And she said, you know, we haven't had indoor plumbing very long. We finally got indoor plumbing in the 50s. And that's telling us that's what we had to use when we were children, you know, the little potties. And, you know, and I got two chamber pots and the bowl and the pitcher and the toothbrush holder and all these things. And I displayed them on this big buffet that I had bought. And so she was very kind. She said, I'm just thinking to tell you that it isn't something that we want to look at as we come into your house. It's something that used to be relegated to the bathroom. I said, well, thank you for telling me that. I said, we Americans love anything that's old. You know, I have friends that collected those bowls and pitchers and potties for years, decorated their house with them, and hadn't thought about people having used them as late as the 50s. That I thought, oh my gosh. So I moved into the bedroom and I was grateful, you know, that she was very nice to tell me that, so nobody took it apart. And so I was grateful for that. So that's the only one. Richard was an antique dealer. He wanted everything. He wanted the biscuit jars. That's why we have so many biscuit jars, because those were his. And biscuit jars are what we call cookie jars.
Okay, yeah.
Biscuit barrels, they were called. They're all china and they're very decorative. And I thought, why do people have them? Then I found out, because every day a woman would take her basket and she'd go down the street. She'd stop at the fruiting place and get her fruit, and she'd go next door to the bakery and get her bread, and she'd go get her meat, and then she'd go to the other place and get her fresh veggies. And it was all in baskets. And so she had, when she got it all home, she had to have a place to put all that stuff. So she'd go to the bakery and get the cookies, or they call the biscuits, you know. So she had to have a cookie jar, as they call them, biscuit barrels. They're very decorative, and all that Richard bought are in there, and they're all over the house. He fell in love with them. So biscuit barrels were suddenly I had. And, you know, my mother said, well, I don't see the barrel. Where's the barrel? I said, Mother, they're china cookie jars or what they are, but they call them biscuit barrels because the women bought their biscuits. They didn't make them. They bought them, like they bought the bread. My daughter, Ricky, it's a wonder they let her back in the country. She was terrible. One night they all went to the movie. They couldn't drive till they were 21. They could buy beer when they were 18, but they couldn't drive till they were 21. So they had one friend that was 21 years old, so he drove them to the movie. When they got out, well, he had to go someplace else. He had to go to work or something. So all the kids started walking home, and they passed the bakery. Ricky was with them, and she said, oh, can you smell that bread? Oh, my gosh, it smells wonderful. And the kids said, yeah, it smells really good. And she said, well, what's it out here for? Well, so it can cool off, so they can sell it tomorrow. She said, they're going to sell it when it's cold, and I mean old and damp and dreary. And, you know, she said, why don't they keep it warm? And she said, oh, we don't eat warm bread. It's not good for you. She said, oh, I wish I could take a loaf home. I would sit you down, I would get the butter out, and I would slather that butter on, and you would love it. So this one little guy named Titch, which is an Australian word for little, he was little. He bought a cape at the nuns' well, it was like a garage sale. They were selling a lot of stuff. And he got this cape. It went all the way down like Batman to the ground. He put that cape around and he sneaked up in that place and he grabbed a loaf of bread and put it under his arm and went back to the kids. Okay, let's go to your house and let's have that bread. He stole it. So Ricky brought him home and she made tea. She got out the butter and that bread was still warm and she sliced it and everybody had tea and hot bread and butter. Even though their mothers had told them it would make them sick, they were brainwashed thinking you can't eat hot bread. It's bad for you. And I thought, oh, Ricky, they're gonna chase us out of the country. Everybody's going to tell them what you did. But she was adamant, you got to learn to eat hot bread. It's so good. So anyway, that's what she was doing. She couldn't drive, but she could be
troublemaker.
Oh, yeah.
Mischievous.
Yeah, she still is.
Is she?
Yes.
I had a picture of her over there in her uniform. She hated that uniform worse than anything in the world. So they had to wear hats, gloves, tie.
Oh, my goodness.
A jacket.
Oh, my goodness.
Their pleated skirt.
Oh, my goodness.
When they went out.
That's Ricky.
Okay.
So do you ever keep in touch with any of the people still in Australia?
Yeah.
You still write to some of those people?
Sometimes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Ricky's online a lot with them. Mm-hmm. All her friends are still there. You know, she's got them. The guy she went with most is married and has 8 children. Oh, I said, goodness. See, if you stayed in Australia, look what you'd have had. Yeah. She said, thank you very much, but no thank you.
So what was your least favorite part of Australia?
Don't know that I have a least favorite part because I was so well accepted.
Was it hot?
No.
Was the weather weird?
No, it was very nice. In this winter, we could just live with a sweater. In fact, we got wonderful wool sweaters that we couldn't get here. I mean, the sweaters were so cheap and they were wool. My son had uniforms like Ricky did, but Ricky's uniform was plaited skirt, so we couldn't wash it.
Oh.
But Chipper's were wool pants.
Oh.
He only had 2 pair, and he had to wear them every day. So he'd wear one, I'd wash it that night and hang it to dry, and the next day, you know. And I thought, we're washing wool in the washing machine. Nobody sent their woolens out to be dry cleaned. Men's suits, maybe, but women's, you know. And the wool was soft and nice and lovely. And, yeah, he didn't mind. Because, you know, the boys' school he went to, they had uniforms they wore like that. But then when they went to do their sports, they had cute uniforms to wear there, too. They'd play ball or whatever they were going to do. They would change out of their uniform and put these other things on. And so he loved going to school there. In fact, when we brought him home, he cried. We went to junior high. He came home one day. He said, I want to go back. Can I go back? I don't like it here. I said, I'm sorry, son. You can't.
So how long did you live in Australia?
2 years.
2 years. And then it was...
What town?
Sale.
Sick.
And that's in a town, Victoria. Oh, Victoria's a state.
S-A-L-E?
Mm-hmm.
Sale.
It's named after a man.
Ah.
I can't remember who he was, but he's...
Yeah. So then it was from Australia back to Kingsville, right?
He lived on 18th Street, 2-story house.
And then you didn't get to pick? Or did you have say in this one?
Oh, I had to say this one. I did. And it worked out fine because Anne and her baby had a room upstairs. It was going to be my studio, but it became their room. And then Ricky had her room, and Tripper had his room, and I had the room downstairs right by the door. And then Anne got married. So I got my studio back. Didn't have it very long because then we went to Alaska. So
how long did you live here before you moved back? Before you moved to Alaska?
A couple of years, I guess. It was short. They were still drilling, and they promoted Richard, a really good promotion. And I said, okay. I was glad we were going there instead of Louisiana.
Yeah. I can see why.
I would love to live in New Orleans, but there's no way I could live in New Orleans. I'd have to live outside somewhere, and I didn't want to do that. I want to live in the French Quarter, but we had children. We couldn't do that.
That would have been a fun place.
So you moved to Alaska around 1975, 76?
1980, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. We were back here long enough to get established again. Then we got moved again. And then we retired in Alaska.
And your kids, by the time you moved to Alaska, were pretty much grown and on their own at that point.
Yes.
Yeah. So they moved to Alaska without kids. Yeah,
without kids. Aunt Ricky came to visit me when Ann and Jack came to visit, and Chip came. And, of course, Chip was crazy about playing golf. Everybody played golf there. And he was loving that.
Still is.
Still is.
Yeah. So you said that you had a studio when you came back to Kingsville. When did you your art career? When did people start?
1971. My friend came to me one day with this two pieces of wood, and she said, "Show me how to make a Santa Claus out of this." And I have no idea. I still have it. It has the date on it when I first started. It was 1971. And so together we looked at, they were identical. They were pieces of her grandmother's porch that they were tearing off because they were moving the house off the farm. It had been sold, and the house, they didn't want the house, so they moved it off. But they had to take the veranda off to get it on the truck. So she got that piece, and they sawed it in half, and it was perfectly matched. So I painted part of mine, and she'd copy, and she'd paint hers. And that's, anyway, that's, she painted that one, and after then she ordered the rest of them from me. So I started in 1971 painting Santa's.
How many did you do that first year, you think?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't even know how many I have.
You have a count of how many you've done, right?
Over through the years. I've never, you know why I know?
I know. You tell
the
me.
The bottoms that. Of the felt that you put on there, it comes off a sticky thing. You pull the sticky thing off and it glues. I save all the little round things, and they're in a container, which I would not dream of trying to count. If somebody's really bored, sometimes they can count them for me because I'm not going to count
so
them.
You think up in the thousands?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them.
Yeah.
It doesn't take long to be painting that much since 71.
Yeah. And they're... So your first one started with just you and another lady coming up with the idea, and then it just took off.
Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted one.
Everybody wanted one. And you never advertised, you've never anything.
Word of mouth and word of Santa.
Well, I'm in trouble with the state.
Why?
Well, I fell, you know, and hurt my hands and my face, my ribs and everything. And so in December, I wasn't very here with it. And I got a letter from the state. They always gave it, sent it to me, and I got it. But I just, you know, I thought, I know what that is. That's a report I'm supposed to send in about sales tax. And I put it aside, and I was trying to learn how to lose my hands again and write checks and mail them. And I ran across this letter. Oh, I've got to do that. So, but and it switched. I got something from it as I had mailed the other letter to them and telling them, even on the sheet of paper that they sent me, I said, I did not paint anything this year and did not sell anything this year, so I don't owe you any sales tax, and mailed it. 2 days later, I get a letter from the secretary under his name, you know, saying, you know, you didn't get it in time. You owe us money, $52. And I told Ricky, I said, I'm not paying. She said, Mother, go ahead and pay it because you didn't do what you were supposed to do. I said, well, I was invalid. I couldn't. She said, I know, but just go ahead. So I did. I sat down and I prayed about it. And I said, well, I'll go ahead and do it. I may have pox upon them, but I'm going to do it. So I wrote this letter that went with the check. And I said, I'm doing this under duress. I want you to know. I'm 87 years old. I paint in a studio in my home. I do not go out and try to get business. It comes to me. And this year, I did not get any business. I've been injured. I couldn't use my hands. I didn't sell anything. And yet, I've got to pay you $52 because I didn't get this report back to you in time. And I said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. And I signed it. And I mailed it to them. And I thought, they may come any day and put me in jail.
I'll visit. I promise.
Okay, visit me, okay.
I'll visit. I promise.
I'm telling you, I'm old and crotchety, and that's okay. I was a good little girl all my life. And
you
by golly,
were not crotchety. I know you, and you were not crotchety. So
anyway, I have to pray for forgiveness every morning because I have evil thoughts.
I think God lets us do that about the state.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Infernal Revenue Service.
The Infernal Revenue.
Well, we still have to render under Caesar.
I know. But we can not be happy
yes,
about
yes,
it.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm going to be painting soon. I've got to paint one for the, already paying one for the college. And that'll be, you know, and I didn't mean to get paid for that, but they sent me a check. So I've got to honor that now. That's money that I got in. So for 2019, I will have a report. Unless I break my hands again, then Ricky can make it for
there
me.
There you go. And she can do
but,
it.
But, you know, the thing is that it all, that last year was a really dead year for me. I didn't feel good. I never did get much done. I had a lot to take care of, and I just didn't make it.
Sometimes the art just doesn't flow.
Mm-hmm.
We have dry spells.
You
don't
need
we?
To have that time. I read that all the time. The artists need to go through that. You can't force it. Mm-mm. But I didn't
it's
get.
Got to be there.
What happened? I had two people that out. I've always been paying for them. It took me all year, the year that Tom died. I mean, right before he died. And I was babysitting him a lot, too. And I just didn't have it in me to paint. But I didn't, you know, that last year I did send my check. I didn't get as many orders. I mean, I didn't complete that many orders. And this year I didn't have any. The ones that I did were ongoing, that you know, I'd had all these blanks for so many months, and I finally got them all done. One man I know, I 18 for him, and they were big ones. And it's really hard for me to hold big ones anymore and paint, but I did it for him. And this other lady, 13 for her, and those were just two people. And so in 1917, I did have the money, I mean, collected the money to give them a good report. Mm-hmm. But 2018, I did not do anything.
It's okay.
But now 2019, I will have, my business will be back.
Okay.
But
are your hands getting better?
Beg pardon?
Are your hands getting better?
This one is, but this one, this is dead right here. Oh. I have no feeling.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, what happened?
Well, I caught myself.
Yeah.
Trying to fall.
Yeah.
I was going to fall on my face. I knew it. And my body was plunging. Mm. And I put my hands out. Don't ever do that. Because my face looked horrible this whole side. I turned like that. It was awful. But it healed real fast. Faster than these have healed. So my handwriting is not good. I've been trying to paint these little Santas for Nikki and Jackie. They want these little tiny Santas. And I'm using my little tiny brush. And I'm not getting the strokes that I use. I have to practice and practice and practice. Now the big ones I can probably do is those little ones that get to me. Yeah.
So you paint the Santas to order, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They send me the wood.
Send you the wood.
And tell me the color and maybe the theme. Like I have some big ones, four, for one family in the valley. And so Ricky, we were in the car the other day, and I said, would you please find out what they want? So you've never told me color or anything, and I can't paint unless they give me instructions. I have no idea what's in their mind. And they were complaining as I hadn't done anything. I hadn't done anything, so I didn't get any instructions, you know. So she called them. You know how she is. She just calls and tells them. Wait, because she's known them all their lives, so she did that because they're friends, kids that she grew up with. Anyway, I heard her talk. Well, I want off-white. And she said, well, what's the other one? What are your other sister? Oh, make them all off-white. And I said, and she said, well, what kind of design do you want them? And she said, Holy Family. I said, okay, that's good. I can do that. Thank you very much. And so there's one that I didn't mention because I've already started it. It was when she went to LSU. Her daughter's going to LSU. And I got a hang up because it was purple. And you know, purple is not a color. Mm-hmm. Purple is a mixture of red and blue. Whatever red and whatever blue you use is going to determine the color of that purple.
Mm.
I needed to get a sample of LSU purple so it wouldn't be the wrong color. I finally got one, so it's painted purple, but I didn't know what she wanted, something from the LSU on there. But she went ahead and told me, her sisters, go ahead and put Holy Family on it, because it is a Christian school, so it's okay. Anyway, I've got to do that. I've got to do those ladies, because I've been waiting a year for it. So I'm trying to catch up now. That's okay. But sometimes artists need to go through a period like that.
A dry period, yes.
Yeah, they do. You have to take it all in and relax and not worry about it. So anyway.
So this Christmas, you gave everybody in your family Santas.
All those Santas that were on the, in the, you know, uh-huh. that were in the
In your art studio, right,
in that are in the show. In the museum.
You had a show. How many did you have on display? I went, but I don't know. I can't.
I'll show you. 40-something.
40-something.
I have the book.
Okay.
You need to stand up.
This little airy fairy friend of ours, this little poet. Uh-huh. I don't know if you know Natalie or not.
Oh, I do know. She wants to be called Natalia now. Yes, I talk all the time.
She made me this. This was the museum show.
Oh, very nice.
And so these are all my Santas, and in the Conner Museum, and I had a formal reception and all these things. So Natalie went down the next day after the opening when nobody was there and took all these pictures.
Very nice.
And made this notebook for me and brought it to me. I thought that was so sweet of
her. She's a sweet lady.
Yes, she is. So this is a record. Since I gave them all to my kids, now I can look back and see what I gave away.
Oh, those are absolutely amazing. Could I digitize this?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm proud of them because they were inspired by my best friend, and now she's gone.
Oh, those are beautiful.
She died this year.
Here we go. Missed one.
And I've done it for the university for years, and I'm amazed at what people will pay for them. But I wouldn't dare ask that kind of price.
Well, I know.
It's amazing.
Well, that's what took me aback. We were visiting somebody, and they were talking about it, and I'm talking over $1,000.
If you buy them at the, you know, if you, there's a thing they published about my ideas. But the fact that I'm just not going to ask people to pay that much. I'm just not, I can't do it. It's not in me to do that. But my little Jackie started out.
They're worth every penny.
John Cothran wanted to ask it. Can your mother paint a Santa? And Jackie said, no, she's really too busy, John. I don't think she can do it. He says, well, can you do it? And she said, yeah, I can do it. And she did one for him. She did it in my studio. So she wanted me to check it, you know. She did a fantastic job. So did you see the one she made for me for Christmas? I've got to show it to you. I've got to have him see it, too.
Now, we're going to go back there to your studio. Is it back there, or you got
it
somewhere?
I'll bring it, because it's such a mess. You'd miss this one.
Okay.
It's special. You've got
all right.
to see it.
Yes, see, she's got granddaughters that are twins.
Belong to her son, Chipper. And one of these, and I don't know which one because I can't remember. But one of them is picking up the mantle.
Really? Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. It's Jackie, and I'm not sure which one is Jackie. I'm thinking this one is Jackie, but I'm not sure. But anyway, this is Jackie, right? Yeah, that's what I thought.
She is something else.
Oh my gosh, look at that.
You recognize what all that is?
That's the stained glass window. Yes. At the church. At our Methodist church.
Isn't that something?
These are her granddaughter went and has painted the stained glass windows of our church on the Santa.
Now she's got orders. John Cochran is ordering from her, and she's trying to keep up with it.
Whether you believe it or not, one of the hardest things to paint when you're painting this are eyes. Because you can make expressionless eyes. Mm-hmm. See, he has an expression. But you can paint eyes that mm-hmm. have no depth, mm-hmm. and they don't look like eyes. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how eyes are one of the hardest things there are.
She got out of college. You know, she didn't major in art. She did get some art classes, but she didn't major in it. But she came out and she graduated. And she said, Mimi, I want to help you paint Santas. I said, oh, great, that's fine. She said, I just want to do it someday. I'll take over your business. And so now she's in the process.
That's what I tell him. Somebody has picked up the mantle.
Uh-huh.
So
anyway, I'm real thrilled about it.
That is just beautiful. She did
the fact that she did this, because I had talked one time about missing the stained glass windows. Uh-huh. And so I told her, I said, I just practically cried when I opened that gift. And I said, oh, honey, I said, this is my favorite one. Jesus at the door.
At the door, yeah. Because
I would go take the children during Sunday school. We'd look at the windows and we'd stop at that one. I said, what do you think about that one? Oh, it's Jesus at the door. I said, yeah, what's special about it?
Finally,
one kid would say, well,
there's can you tell what's special about the door? What do you usually see on a door that isn't on that door?
It's open.
No, it's closed.
It's closed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's a closed door.
You don't see a doorknob.
Oh, okay.
That's what this little boy said. There's no way he can open the door, maybe.
Oh, okay.
And I said, no, that's your heart. He can't just plunge in. He just can't rip it open and come
you
in.
You have to invite him. You have to invite him in. So you would have to open the door.
Yeah, that was
on your side.
That's the Sunday school lesson that we always taught them. You know, they were, and I said, that door meant so much to me. You know, yeah. She had her mother go to Pastor Valley and ask if she could go in the sanctuary and take pictures of the stained glass window. So Pastor went with her. And Pastor said it was a beautiful day. It was just made for it. The sun was just right, so all the windows shone from each side, you know, like the sun was everywhere. And she said the slides were gorgeous.
Is it going to be even more special if we have to say goodbye to that building and those windows?
Break my heart. But, I mean, you've got to be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, someone said, well, can the stained glass windows be saved? I said, sure, you can always take those out. It's a protective thing on the outside, so it's, you know.
So, you've lived in this house and had your art studio in the back for how many years?
Moved here in 1986. I mean, 2086, whatever. No, 1986. Yeah, 1986 we moved in here. And that was the playroom. And I turned it on.
And that was after Richard retired from Humboldt.
All this we retired
in Alaska.
You know what we paid for this house is ridiculous. What we didn't get it for today. It was just we bought it from Exxon. An engineer had lived in it, and they paid him. They bought it from him, and so we got to buy it from Exxon. And you just wouldn't believe how cheap we got this house.
Oh, that's good.
He got a bonus for retiring. They wanted him to retire. Because his salary had gotten so high, and they were going to keep sending him off places, they'd have to pay him extra for something. He said it'd be cheaper with his age to go ahead and retire him. He didn't really want to retire, but I said, but honey, you can't do all the work you used to do. You can't stay up 24 hours a day. You've got to get your rest at your age. So he took it, and I was glad he took up. We gave him golf lessons. We gave him everything to have something to do. We put him on the city commission and, you know, did all kinds of things like that. The whole family worked to get him something to do. But he ended up enjoying his retirement. But he enjoyed cutting out the Santas more than anything. He became my right-hand man. We've got all kinds of junk, and it's still all there. I had a son-in-law that would come and help occasionally, and then Tom used to, of course. Now Tom's dead. So I'm going to have to do something drastic and get rid of that, because I'm not allowed to use those electric things, a saw and that kind of thing.
Yeah, what you paint with, right?
Uh-huh. So anyway.
Well, who knows what Nathan will pick up.
I know. So anyway.
Jackie's husband.
Jackie's wanting to take over the business. Now she's working in Corpus. I don't know how she does what she does. She quit here because they had her so busy with athletic departments, she couldn't do anything. And she was being overworked and not paid enough. So she goes to Corpus and gets $2,000 more for what she was doing here. And now they're doing this. She's not in the athletic department. She's in the fine arts. But I asked her mother, I said, did she come home? I missed her. She hadn't been here in 3 weeks. Oh, she said she's got so much to do over there. She's one of those take charge people, get it organized and do it. And they let her. They do. Besides that, she took up photography. She does beautiful photography. I didn't know anything about it. I saw her pictures, but I didn't know what is involved. She has this camera or phone or whatever she's using. She puts the people where she wants them, and then she clicks it. She sends it to them, and it's up to them to get it developed and printed and all that. So she doesn't have to do that. All she does is set up and take it, and she's getting a fortune.
That's good. That's good. That's good. Yeah. So you've lived in this house since 1986.
Yeah. We bought it from Humboldt, because Exxon, because the man who lived here was an employee that was promoted and sent somewhere else, and they just bought it from him rather than putting it on the market and not knowing when it's going to see this, paid Exxon for it. And we found out Exxon was going to sell it, so Richard just called and said, I want it. So,
cool. And you lost your precious Richard when?
Oh, gosh. I'm just terrible with dates. It seems like forever, but it wasn't. The kids, the girls were in kindergarten, and now they're graduating from college 2 years, so it's been a while.
It's been a while.
I don't dwell on it. I just know it happened.
I know.
But anyway, it's okay. He's still around.
That's right. That's right.
Every time I'm in bed and I hear a crash, there's no point getting up. There's nothing happened. It's just he bumped into something.
He bumped into something. You moved something and he couldn't find his way again, right? Right?
He was so clumsy. And I used to worry about it. Now I just laugh. I said, no, it's okay. No problem.
So you want to walk back to the art studio?
See, my junk is pretty junky. I'm collecting stuff for the rummage sale, too.
That's okay.
So I sell back there. But I like to see the painting that I did on the way up to the little Eskimo baby, because when that girl told me, oh, they're so ugly, I just couldn't wait to paint a baby, and she's so cute.
Yeah, definitely want to get that. We're going to conclude the oral history part. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we conclude?
Oh, I forgot you were even doing that. I probably should
have
said
it. No, you did. No, that's what makes it good.
Oh, I just love to visit with friends.
Very good. Well, thank you. Thank you for your time.